I mean, the interesting thing is why, say, the storyline of the Democratic Party wasn't convincing enough for most of the voters. And that's, you know, that seems to be quite obvious. So, I mean, and arguing that Donald Trump is a threat to the democracy, that he is a misogynist, that he's a convicted felon, and all of that is, you know, empirically right and accurate. But, I mean, then the thing is just reminding prospective voters about that apparently doesn't really automatically mean that they will vote for the Democratic Party. And I think that's something that we've now repeatedly seen. 2020 was sort of a little bit bad, of course, because Biden was elected, but as such, it wasn't also that people seemed to be terribly convinced. It was also rather this, apparently the sentiment of, oh, instead of giving Trump a second term, we'll rather have that other old man. But it was not that there was this kind of drive or euphoria almost, or kind of, you know, very positive atmosphere that people would say, oh, this is really something new. And I think Democratic, we see that as such. Of course, we have seen the rise of populist parties throughout the West. They all have different levels of success. And of course, that is the structural problem. It's something that is pretty evident if you look at the United States. Even if you now look to the very bizarre Canadian politics, you know, they're for the first time, they are really having a rather tense debate on immigration, which, you know, was not the case for decades. I mean, that there are always some topics that sort of pop up where a majority of the population is either conceives of a certain problem as the most pressing one, even if, you know, other politicians then tend to say they should better explain their policies because apparently the populace is too stupid to understand it. So, I mean, I think a lot of people are fed up with that kind of, you know, they see some kind of disconnect. And they then buy into the often cheap and very sort of simplistic argumentation of populists, of course. But, I mean, that's, so that I think the big question for the coming be to actually
to find
a positive or successful formula to that kind of mostly right-wing populism.
Yes, but it's also like for me, when I observed the campaign, what kind of struck me was this kind of very strong emphasis on the idea that he's authoritarian, like the whole concept of a threat to democracy, which again, I find just like a very, such a simplistic argument, which again, like works for like kind of exciting your own kind of like charged voters, but it's completely useless because, I mean, it's obvious action. It is a competitive thing and kind of like invoking those phantoms of like authoritarian leader. Like, I mean, it's just not a serious campaign kind of like design, so to speak. I mean, I think it's like one thing to notice again, as what we discussed already, it's just a campaign failure, right? And they will need to find ways to.
The topics were set by Trump, and it was migration, or it was illegal immigration. It was the southern border, and it was the economy. And now it's quite obvious that the Democratic Party then didn't vote that they would do it any better. Now, of course, there are the rhetoric by Trump is simply terrible, because he uses that. The wording that really reminded me of, you know, Third Reich speeches. I mean, if you say, for instance, that illegal immigration poisons the blood of the American people, I mean, that's kind of a language that is just terrible, and that's or worse than terrible, and that's appalling for me. But I mean, the entire insults to parts of the American population that he gets away with such a rhetoric. I mean, that's sort of the problem that apparently people still that. That's what I at least read, is that they still think that they might be economically better off having him in the White House than Kamala Harris. So, I mean, then it's pretty obvious, and I'm repeating myself, that the Democratic Party doesn't have a convincing program how to solve those problems. And, I mean, maybe there may be some kind of delusion, but I mean, people also argued that, you know, people are voting irrationally, but I mean, then more than half Americans would be you know, completely irrational. I mean, I think that's
most of the,
you can argue that. I think it's sort of a very cheap line of argumentation.
Yeah, I think so too. And I guess the striking difference to 2020, they ran with this, like Biden ran with this unifying idea that's kind of unified. And like now they did the opposite. So they basically tried to completely alienate people who vote for Trump, just like pressing those charges and just saying whatever. But and then they just did the opposite. That's why now I guess it feels like really bad for Democrats, because now after all this rhetoric, very charged rhetoric, it's really hard to come to terms with the reality that majority of population just chose the autocrat or the person who kind of like represents all the bad things in your country. But what's interesting, I guess we can kind of switch the gears, because this time certainly foreign policy was big in the agenda, especially the war in Ukraine, I guess, certainly affected some voters. I mean, at least
I haven't had a look at that closely enough, but I mean, as such, I think it's a pretty much a standard reply that foreign policy doesn't matter that much in US election. It may have but I think then it was related to the economic situation as such, and what is it that the state should spend money on, and how should the economic system be run? And if that is related to economic policies, the war in Ukraine, support for the war in Ukraine, tariffs, and you know, sort of the unfair treatment by these, or I mean, trying to reduce or simply do away trade deficits, that's of course, you know, the foreign policy comes in, I guess, now in the Trump administration.
But I would still say like the ballot was about either you have like this idea of stopping the war in Ukraine or continuing support. And in this sense, like, of course, I mean, you can like argue very convincingly that like the whole Biden campaign against Russia was a complete failure from American perspective, right? Because you eventually got a person in the White House who diametrically opposite ideas, the way he presents it, right? He ran his campaign with this idea of having the war in Ukraine in one night or whatever.
In 24 hours.
24 hours. But I mean, it's like, for me, it's interesting because of course, I mean, you cannot really pick apart like why people, for example, chose Trump. But I have like a certain feeling that, of course, people who went to vote, Ukraine was somewhere there in the agenda for them.
I, to be honest, I haven't had a look at that in detail, but from what I read, it was not really much of an issue. But I think that the overall thing, I mean, if we talk about Biden and making a convincing case, I think we sort of have to peck it a little bit. And I think the Iraq war was a failure. The Afghanistan mission was a failure. The support at the beginning for Syrian rebels bringing down Bashar al-Assad was a failure. The Libya air campaign that led to, you know, the end of the Gaddafi regime, at least didn't produce a stable post-war state. We have otherwise, you know, with the pullout from most of the Sahel region countries, especially pullout of France and now soon Germany from Mali, places like that, Chad, Niger, we see that an overall strategy that started in the early 2000s, and the US and a lot of its partners, and at times they, you know, work together, at times it was one state or, you know, a sort of loose alliance of states, it all hasn't really worked out. I would say has been the case for Ukraine, but primarily because, and that's something we've been discussing now for more than 2 years, that this thing that Russia mustn't win this war and be rewarded for conquering a Ukrainian territory. As a normative line, that's a perfectly legitimate point, but then you have to strategically assess how can you go about that. Now, one might think that if we had sent more weapons, or if there had been, you know, some sort of more higher material support, that the situation on the battlefield might be a little bit different or might be significantly different. But as such, the main problem is still that Russia must win the war and Ukraine must win the war. And it was never defined how that sort of winning looks like. And I think the problem and the sort of helplessness or the kind of strange situation is something that you see in that comment by Zelensky now on congratulating Donald Trump when he talks about somehow being positive or looking forward or, you know, thinking that Trump's peace through strength initiative might be, you know, successful.
But I think he already said, like, yesterday that yes, Trump has a peace plan, but it doesn't mean that we will subscribe to it, you know, something like this. Oh, he wants to end the war in one day. That's not our idea.
he may say that, but I mean, yeah. what you could see is just in the way that foreign leaders congratulated Donald Trump, they all anticipate huge changes in U.S. foreign policy. And most pundits, and I think rightly, say that there will be sort of an isolationist perspective. And I, from the coverage on the Trump rallies, I noticed that foreign policy lines that he always repeated at this under his watch had been less conflicts in the world. And I mean, of course, there is all this bogus stuff where you won't be able to sort of prove his point. But I mean, of course, had remained in power, the pullout in Afghanistan would have been so much different. All that kind of nonsense, or, you know, at least things that are unclear, because I mean, they are just, you know, hypothetical. But I mean, one could certainly say that he has a very different take on foreign policy, primarily focused on the economy. Mm-hmm. And this entire idea of, you know, policing the world or somehow using the U.S. military in all kinds of regions of the world for power projection and being that hegemon is at least in question. And sort of how that plays out is, of course, now a question that we will have to address. I mean, there are some people who say that since he is so isolationist, he will simply yield ground to other forces. I think that's sort of a line that you often hear from Democrats. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, the war will really be finished soon in Ukraine, but it will be at the cost of a lot of territory that the Ukrainians will have to cede. And in essence, it will mean that Russia wins the war. I don't fully believe that kind of reasoning. But I mean, there were, of course, some very erratic position or developments under Trump. I mean, his meetings with Kim Jong-un that, you know, none of his advisors actually supported. And I guess it's safe to say that there will be some very unorthodox, maybe that's a nice mism, some very unorthodox approaches to some foreign policy issues by Donald Trump. And then the question is how that will play out.
There is what we can observe already. There is a lot of optimism on the Russian side. And it's like something is, you can see that something there is a movement which was impossible, obviously, under Biden, and wouldn't be impossible.
Clean movement in the sense of there is more flexibility, or there is now the likelihood increased that there might be some kind of, I wouldn't call it rapprochement between Russia and the US, but there will be that the possibility of direct talks now is higher. Is that what you mean?
Yes, it's like there is a window of opportunity, right? It would be impossible to imagine that Putin would congratulate Kamala Harris with election. Like, it wouldn't happen. And of course, that's already interesting. That's like, I guess, one big development, because at least for like next 2 years, and maybe you have like a re-election in the Congress, you have like an opportunity to really solve to attempt to solve the conflict from the American perspective. And it's actually one of the easiest things to deliver for American president, because it's obviously under his control, you know, stopping sending money to Ukraine, especially with the Congress. It's also quite feasible. But then, of course, the interesting thing...
I mean, now you're talking just about... It is possible as such. But of course, with it comes wider considerations of what does that signal to all other countries, you know, challenging the United States. And I mean, in that sense, I still couldn't really make sense of the meeting Kim Jong-un, also, you know, at least having several private meetings with Vladimir Putin. That was bizarre. At the same time, he was harder and harsher in terms of sanctions and any other kind of, you know, military threats, etc., when it came to Iran. And I mean, and in economic terms, he pushed very hard against the Chinese by introducing all the tariffs, starting a trade war that then continued under Biden.
But then,
so, I mean, in that sense, for me, it's still very strange that those who claim that he's isolationist, that he likes strongmen, or he's at least, you know, not appalled by them, or, you know, doesn't criticize them as strongly as most Democratic and other U.S. presidents did in the past, that this is somehow an indication that he basically is to cede this, you know, American superiority or the possibility to project power. Because, I mean, in that sense, it's an inconclusive picture, because at the same time, we see that he then talked about the JCPOA as the worst, you know, possible deal, was also considering, I think, at some stage to also have a military attack or against Iran. I mean, and what is certainly true is that there is political and military collaboration between North Korea, Russia, and Iran, and certainly some tacit approval of some other kind of, you know, delivery of additional shipments from the Chinese. I mean, those four countries are really working together. And I mean, if you treat two of them almost as, you know, potential partners, and the other ones, which already have been facing, you know, severe consequences or being always considered sort of at least a rival or even an enemy, that you sort of continue that line and make them stronger. I think that's still something where I still cannot make sense of, you know, the Trump presidency, the first Trump presidency. So I'm really curious how this will play out. I mean, we'll see.
It's also interesting to look at the Russian perspective, because you rightly pointed out to the fact that, of course, there is a cooperation between, you know, China, Iran, like North Korea and Russia. But like, to be honest, like the more I can do research on Russia, I understand that Russia, like, it's not what Russia wants from the world. What probably Russia wants is integration in the West, potentially. This is like interesting for it, from economic, from any person, to be honest. You can imagine how much it gains if it stops the war and opens up to the West. It's probably going to be like 8%, 10% GDP growth. It's after this years of kind of struggling with sanctions and basically like living on its own. And then I look into this again from the perspective of if this is what really Russia wants from the West, like person as a Trump is like an interesting character to kind of work with, or at least like to like probe. Then you can think about, well, if Russia aligns with the US, then the US solves all its like kind of problems in the world. Like it solves Iran problem, largely because there is no more cooperation, especially in the ballistic missile domain. Like North Korea, it's like the Russian alliance with North Korea is actually very, like, I don't think it's serious alliance, obviously. It's like, it's what probably Russia is doing just like to like hurt the US, right? Because there's no real substance between alliance, but like behind this alliance.
I mean, like, I guess from a global structural perspective, and we also have been discussing that frequently, that there is currently the United Nations Security Council, or the United Nations system, most of it is really broken. And yeah. I mean, certainly the UN Security Council doesn't work, because I mean, there's always a veto by one power if, you know, there is to be found any kind of common formula. I think we can actually see that with regard to North Korea. I just listened the other day to an interview with the Russian ambassador to the UK, where he was confronted by the fact that also Russia had, you know, signed up for sanctions against North Korea. Mm-hmm. That was one of those previous unanimous votes in the United Nations Security Council, which, you know, saw that all countries were supporting the sanctions. Apparently, China's still upholding those sanctions in that area. But I mean, the Russian ambassador said that, you know, it's basically being paused at the moment, the kind of, you know. But I mean, that technically, the Russians are, you know, not enforcing this. So, I mean, if that's kind of the overall pattern in global politics, that, you know, sort of pick and choose, would follow those kind of rules. I mean, we are in very uncharted waters. It may well be that, you know, the hypothetically speaking, that, you know, if Russians and Americans were working closer together, maybe you can put it that way, that some other problems could be solved more easily or would basically exist. But I mean, that I think is too unrealistic in a sense. I mean, that's quite a stretch. No, but I mean, if you look at it was a way smaller country, right? Syria, how all Western leaders condemned Bashar al-Assad and was basically saying, you know, we have to end this terrible regime. And that he, I think, has been courted now by all kinds of neighbors who also send weapons and basically try to bring him down in the wider region, like the UAE or Saudi Arabia or others. I mean, if you see how he's now going to summits, meet those, you know, leaders from neighboring countries, there might be something like that, you know, happening where Putin or a future leader of Russia might actually make it. But I mean, I think that's maybe 10, 15 years down the line. But I mean, I wouldn't see it. And I mean, this would be very much a realpolitik kind of approach. Because I mean, just if you look at the rhetoric that was used against Putin, of course, it was again Hitler, who, you know, there have been so many Hitlers around, Milosevic and Hussein and Vladimir Putin and King Jong-un. And I mean, it's sort of, I think, not very fruitful in an analytic sense. But I mean, there was a lot of, and he's certainly an autocrat, but I mean, this entire rhetoric of that there is no way that we can work together with such a state and with such an autocrat, I mean, just in order to cooperate, I have to get rid of that kind of, because otherwise it would be completely implausible. Or I mean, it would sound ridiculous, like a broken promise, like, I mean, not a trustworthy position whatsoever. I mean, it would just sound like, you know, some kind of cheap rhetoric that you used in order to achieve certain, and then you just flip-flop and say, oh, well, we didn't really mean it that seriously. And I mean, if you then, you know, give us some cheap gas, we'll somehow get along. I mean, frankly, I don't see it. At least not in the near future. I mean, what I think is rather something that could happen is what also now Emmanuel Macron again mentioned with regard to the European position towards China, but now seems to be kind of this new rift that I'm curious how the Trump administration will deal with that is, again, the post-Braindead debate kind of strategic autonomy concept. So my idea, what we're seeing at the moment is, irrespective of whether it's the UK, which had this kind of strange paper now with the Germans on increased defense spending, French investment in defense, that, and also smaller countries now making the case for European strategic autonomy, also in a military sense, I think that's something we should follow closely, because I could expect, I'm sure that Trump will again come with, you know, NATO, the 2% target that many countries are not meeting it. Whether that will result in the end of NATO, we'll see. But I mean, what it will certainly again reignite are the discussions on strategic autonomy, or whether there is some kind of European part of NATO that might somehow act. Irrespective of what it does. And I mean, for them, it's always a problem, and the Democrats always hated it. It started under Albright and the others, and it was always this thing that, while we would have liked to see the Europeans actually pay their fair share, we don't want to be able to act autonomously. And I think that's always the stretch that was there.
But actually, my analytical guess would be Democrats always hated it, because strategic autonomy for Europe would probably mean realignment with Russia.
Yes, absolutely, but that's what I mean. But they had a very sort of schizophrenic about it, because I mean, both Republicans and Democrats agree on one thing, that Europeans should increase their defense spend, and then they would all be very happy if the Americans could spend less, because the Americans would, sorry, the Europeans would compensate for that. But I think the main thing is that within the Republican Party, there is now no consensus, and that we will see how that plays out. I'm pretty sure that Trump, even if it sounds ironic, will most likely be open to strategic autonomy by the Europeans, because from his sort of more isolationist perspective, that is something, and apparently his unwillingness or not strong support of NATO, it's something that he would rather you know, accept than a Democratic president. We certainly see that it doesn't, you know, square with the Democrats. But I mean, they have been inconsistent in that sense, because on the one hand, they wanted the U.S. to spend more, but then they didn't want any decoupling, duplication, you know, these kind of three Ds that, you know, of that already Madeleine Albright talked about in the end of the 90s.
Because, I mean, my take is still the same on the concept of European autonomy. If you take the U.S. out of equation and suddenly there is no U.S. troops in Europe, like, there is no way Europe can afford, like, to have, like, a bad relationship with Russia, just especially after this war, because they will just probably, without any hesitation, go to Baltics, for example. Like, you know, but not just because of, like, Russian military projection, but it just makes from, if you don't have such a big partner as the U.S., you would probably want to have some type of relationship with a country, like such a country as Russia. It's kind of against your own, European interests, if they were like clear cut European interests.
But the thing is, how would you arrange? I mean, we talked about this also in previous conversations, whether there could be something like a new Cold War also being really a demarcation line that you say, you know, this is heavily actually fortified border between Belarus and the Baltic countries, Russia and the Baltic countries, or whether there is some kind of cozying up or rapprochement between the Europeans and Russia. I think for the time being, it would be something very, very strategic in the sense, yes, in order not to spend even more on defense, we still make that deterrent capability credible. And that's what still most European countries will agree on. I'm not sure about Korea and places like that, but they really don't matter that much for the, but I mean, France, Germany, certainly Poland, and most likely also Finland and Sweden, they would be, and Denmark, they would certainly be willing to spend more money and just make this deterrent credible. And I mean, some discussions that were now already starting, where if were to get rid out of, or the Americans were to get out of NATO, or if they were to actually pull out their nuclear weapons and would basically end this concept of the nuclear umbrella that applies especially for Italy and Germany, that even the Germans might have to consider acquiring nuclear weapons. Another concept was, of course, that of sharing that with the French, or somehow have closer cooperation in Germany and the UK and France. But I think we'll see a lot of these discussions now starting very early on. I expect we will see more communiques, speeches, and some kind of things in February, March. They will be coming pretty soon.
Certain. There's definitely some type of movement going on. But it's interesting because I think what you just mentioned, it's certainly kind of based on the conception that Russia necessarily opposes Europe. But like what you hear, and this is, I mean, what you hear from like Lavrov, Putin, that like they still saying the same thing all over again, Russia belongs to Europe. It's like they're saying it in all type of, which is in itself very interesting. There is like the whole multipolarity thing. I guess it's another layer and another layer to the complexity. But one thing that they never abandon saying that like Russia belongs to Europe and it's a European country and there isn't like we're not going anywhere from Europe. So I think like their end goal, and I mean it also makes I think sense from any type of identity politics, of course. And now with the like, kind of like the war with Ukraine, when the question became so kind of heated, of course it's hard to imagine that they would draw the line along the Dnieper River and just say, oh, you know, this is where we like end the European integration. So, I mean, that's why I'm saying that what Russia is doing in Ukraine is probably holding Ukraine as a hostage, like in the conflict, in the kind of in its negotiation, maybe with the West. So it's like if you want to integrate Ukraine, you can only probably do it with Russia together. So this is like, I mean, I'm playing with this idea because it's kind of, I don't know, in my mind, it makes sense. But it's,
I guess you have to dissect different levels.
Yeah, and that's
it's
true.
I think it's the least contested one is that we say that geographically, Russia and of course also Ukraine belong to Europe. Yeah. That sort of, and so everyone's saying that, you know, Russia is Europe, even if you say in Western Europe, is not per se considered problematic. I think where it becomes tricky is when you then talk about political cooperation, any kind of form of either economic exchange, political exchange, because there the main line of argumentation will be, hey, we tried that, you know, with the peace dividend, we always, you know, had open Russia closer to Europe. I mean, the Germans had this modernization partnership, Modernisierungspartnerschaft, which, you know, never really worked out. And I think the main area of tension, or simply the main level or area of conflict, is that of, you know, what is it to be European in terms of certain values? And that is, and it does have a degree of double standards at times. It also has this kind of problematic morality dimension to it. But I mean, there, I think that is where the rapprochement, or, you know, the future collaboration with the Russians will actually be the hardest to achieve, because I mean, the European line will always be, I mean, how on earth could you start this war against Ukraine, and how on earth can you expect us as Europeans to believe you, first of all, that you are not, you know, trying to conquer other European states and that we should sort of collaborate with you, but also you are treating all of the European values of, you know, the Enlightenment or what have you, all, you know, the things of, you know, European friendship, you all basically did away with that when you invaded Ukraine. So I mean, this is why there's no way for us to work together with you Russians. And I think it's at that level where we'll have to see changes in case there is to be any closer working together with us.
But don't you think those kind of narratives, they can disappear actually pretty quickly? Because no one already kind of like asks those questions to Serbia when they try to integrate Serbia now. And like Serbia is, I mean, obviously was a boogeyman in the 90s.
And but let's, I mean, first of all, Milosevic is no longer in power.
Yeah, but like Putin is not going to be forever. So.
Yeah, yes. But I mean, yes, if there is a new leader, that would certainly make things things easier or more likely. But the second consideration is, of course, that of this entire thing of the zone of peace. And, you know, there European leaders are not terribly happy with Viktor Orban. I know Viktor Orban is not, you know, you mentioned Serbia. But I mean, they're not happy with a person like Orban, but they grudgingly accept that. And they also grudgingly accept the kind of rhetoric that that they hear from Serbia, because they say, in the end, if we somehow integrate Serbia, the likelihood that we will have to another Balkans war is just significantly reduced. I think that's sort of the line of reason by most policymakers. Of course, it's way smaller. I mean, Belgrade, I mean, it's and Serbia is so much smaller as compared to Russia that they would say, okay, that's sort of a different kind of where we can... Yeah. Where we can also look away and maybe don't, you know, point fingers as much to things that we don't actually like that much or that we oppose. So I think it's way more out in the open if we talk about European-Russia relations. I mean, because it's all aspects of scale, right? I mean, it's so many more people. It's such...
It's also... Like there's obviously like an interplay between EU, Russia, and the US. I mean, like everything that happens in the domain of US Russia relations, particularly EU Russia relations, like you cannot really get rid of one component of this relationship, so to speak. It's like it's a very entangled. So
I mean, I think that's there are plenty of and research out there, but of course it's the strange thing that with NATO, which always so far preceded EU enlargement, and now the question was whether it was the other way around. So I mean, there was always military integration before economic integration, at least on paper, and it was always first the Europeans and the Americans partnering with a new country before the partnership with intensified because they came and that is either a EU member or a NATO member, something I think that now where the overlap now has, you know, been reduced I mean, we see that in the Balkans. We do also have a lot of NATO members now that are not EU members. So, I mean, there we see that, still see that pattern. But, I mean, if we look at the way how, especially under Sarkozy and presidents, the European Union also tried to make sense or in its immediate neighborhood, you know, with the Eastern Partnership or with the kind of partnership with the Mediterranean countries, especially North Africa, sort of how this played out, we see that it is, these are those two underlying logics. One the military one, mainly pushed by NATO, another one of wider political economic integration, and also that comes with you know, democratization and some kind of oversight. So I'm curious how that plays out. What I found very interesting is that before the war in Ukraine started, and I mean, now I'm talking 2022, not 2014, but I mean, as such, there were always debates whether, in the early 2010s, whether there would be economic integration first, meaning rather that Ukraine become a part of the European Union than NATO, right? I mean, there was this sort of
backtrack
because of the failure of the Bucharest summit. So I mean, that the entire thing, whereas NATO really abandoned, hey, Georgia and Ukraine will become a part of NATO. I mean, it was sort of hitting that pause button, right? I mean, I think that's what all analysts agree is, even Putin would agree on that, right? I mean, that sort of this, it was strategically unclear what I would consider a sort of pause button, right? Because it was always said, you know, you might become a member at some stage, but I mean, as such, an open map. And I mean, most people said it's very unlikely.
But
that happened, during the same time, the sort of economic integration and sort of closer cooperation with the European Union continued. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we see way stronger cooperation with the European Union and Georgia. We saw the same thing with Ukraine. So,
but it's also,
therefore, the strategic economy thing will be very, very interesting. I mean, I'm really curious how European leaders will actually take that additional leverage that the Trump presidency gives them, how they will use it. Because, I mean, frankly, it does give Europe more room for maneuver, whether you like it or not. And you can even say it's important that we keep the Atlantic Alliance. I mean, I'm all not saying that this, you know, shouldn't be, not that it doesn't make sense. I'm just saying, as such, I would assume that the Trump presidency gives Europeans actually more leeway. I mean, the way that they could realize the strategic autonomy concept is at least has grown more likely. And they might even have to do it because, I mean, if the worst case scenario happens, it would be that Trump pulls America of NATO or somehow, you know, makes NATO more or less irrelevant. And that's
what I actually raise the issue, because, of course, you have Trump, and Trump is just like one personality. And of course, you have whatever you call it, like a bureaucratic apparatus in the US that is very much so for basically accepting Ukraine into NATO. That is like has been moving NATO towards Russia for like a long time now. And I mean, it's not like it disappears in one day. I mean, Trump probably cannot really, you know, drain the swamp to this extent. Or even maybe he doesn't want to, because again, Trump's not a person who has ever like given any critical thought to the concept of NATO expansion. Don't think he's the guy, right? He's not the guy who's responsible for this type of policy. So it's interesting because now with Ukraine and Trump becoming president, you have this issue that the conflict is about accepting it into NATO. I mean, I don't think any American administration can subscribe to that they won't expand further. Probably not. I mean, even Trump cannot do it. But this is the only thing that Russians can really want from them. So then it's interesting how it will kind of, I mean, how we will see again the whole reiteration of the open door policy under new Trump administration. Because if, for example, if you get just the whole Ukraine will join NATO, even under new Trump, that is just very interesting, because it actually means there is like kind of like a deep state that moves like the whole concept forward, right? Because even if Trump rhetorically won't support it, but you get the same declaration, NATO declaration, you know, Ukraine will join NATO one day, right? This is would be very interesting to see, actually. And then
I wouldn't call it a deep state. I mean, just in the class we had, we read Graham Allison, right, on mm-hmm. the three different models. I mean, this sort of still strange rational actor assumption, but then bureaucratic politics and, you know, organizational politics. I mean, how, you know, decisions are being made. And of course, you most likely refer to by the deep state are simply people who've been working, you know, either for the State Department or for the Pentagon mm-hmm. or even, you know, agencies like the CIA force. And of course, they are sort of socialized into a system where they have a very specific kind of worldview. And then mm-hmm. sort of that translates into certain, you know, ideological positions, if you want to call it that way, and where they, you know, see a certain kind of options on the table. I think where Trump really creates or almost, you know, the presence of Trump really makes things different is that there are now more options on the table. And whether that's a good mm-hmm. or bad thing is, I mean, up for others to decide. Yeah. But what you called the deep state, and if you refer to that as, you know, just trained diplomats, security advisors, people from, you know, kind of the, let's call it mainstream, who are having the same of policy approach, irrespective of whether they're old traditional Republicans or Democrats, they would never have pondered the idea of Trump meet Kim Jong-un. I think that's a pretty, pretty safe way to say. Mm-hmm. This was always considered, you know, if you do that, you're basically strengthening a person that you don't want to strengthen, mm-hmm. and also the likelihood that you will get an outcome is close to zero. Mm-hmm. That's how it apparently, or quite obviously, played out, at least for mm-hmm. now. So what I would expect is that there can be some very erratic, or at least surprising for most pundits, things that can happen. I think if I were a European policymaker, I would have this one strategic objective. First of all, keep the European sort of partners in NATO unified and sort of, mm-hmm. you know, ensuring that they all have the same strategic path or position. Where certainly is Russia perceived as a threat, and where, you know, the future will tell how you sort of deal with that, but that you at the same time ensure that the United States stay within NATO. Mm-hmm. And I think the way you have to do it is you have to change the complete narrative, because I mean, Trump is basically saying we're pouring a shitload of money into an organization from which we don't benefit. So, I mean, if they all, you know, spend 2%, that's one thing. And I think that's something that Trump can achieve. The other thing is that European leaders have to convince Donald Trump that it might actually be useful to remain in NATO. And I think the only way they can do that would be maybe to somehow link to anything that is happening in East Asia, China. Mm. But I mean... If there is, of course, Article 5, it will make the likelihood of the Chinese government actually attacking the US at least less likely. Because, I mean, in strategic calculations, you would say if we really risk a war with the United States, at least we would have to anticipate that the European partners will join. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, that's the only thing where I think that you could tell Trump that NATO has... or it's beneficial for the United States. If it costs a lot of money, that it still allows the Americans to project their military power in a more efficient way. And that eventually might actually lead to something that we've seen also in the past, that you could somehow then get Russia back into the fold. So, I mean, if you think of it like very old Metternich, Bismarckian... Churchillian, Machiavellian kind of realist terms. I mean, there might be some kind of approach where you will get Russia sever its ties with China, because it's China that you actually want to, you
of
know,
course, yeah. I mean, that's what
challenge from raising or raising even further.
But also,
see how that ends.
I mean, what we discussed. The whole Russian, I mean, Russia is obsessed with the West. I mean, it's like the obsession, and you can see it in a way, in the rhetoric, in whatever Russia is doing, like since 90s, it's basically doing to get like something from the US and from the West. I mean, US, the West, here you can, I guess, conflate the nouns. And which again is interesting because it, like every Russian action, like since 90s, it can be really documented really well. It tries to provoke the US to do something. So it's like a very relational, so to speak, thinking that kind of gets them into dance, so to speak. So like Russian actions, they're not really, not in a sense independent, but they have like the audience in the West, so to speak. And in this sense, I think it's just very useful to look at Russian actions, like with this perspective of whatever Russia tries to achieve, it actually tries to achieve from the West. It doesn't try to achieve.
But that would mean that Russian foreign policy, and especially when Ukraine is a complete misinterpretation,
yeah,
by the intentions in the West, because I mean it's basically seen as this neo-imperialist country that tries to conquer the largest swaths of land that it can, and otherwise is completely antagonistic to anything that is Western European or related to European. Yeah. Your basic point is there is at least a different layer to that. Because, I mean, it's pretty hard to argue against that military perspective. Because, the war is happening, that's a fact. And, I mean, reasons why it started, there is a lot of discussion on that, how it could play out in the end, and what is it that, each country wants. It's also something contested. If you listen to Ukrainians, will most likely be very different from the Russians, but also from different European sources. This thing that it's all about a neo-imperial project is at least a very common narrative that you hear.
And I mean, it's the other way around. If you go to realist perspective, they would go they'll try really hard to prove like this fact that it's NATO that caused this conflict, which again it's not. I mean, it has its own kind of meaning this type of research, but then again it kind of disconnects maybe Russian own intentions, because it's very interesting to see how Russia, like even like just you have the one layer is just Russian foreign policy actions, and how they always like kind of since like 90s and since like this like rejection bias, I mean perceived rejection, right, how Russians like have they have been doing everything to kind of get back on track, like America, so to speak, to prove to the US that, you should listen to us. And then, of course, you have the second layer, this like identity crisis in Russia, that is, the whole debate whether we are Eurasian or Western, which, I mean, in itself proves that there is like the debate is fake, because it's like, I mean, again, Chinese people know they are Chinese. And like in Russian, they try really hard to prove to themselves that they are not Western. And by proving, they go into this deep length of like, trying to create like this story. And I mean, the whole story of proving, I guess, points to the direction at least that there is some Western in you, because otherwise, who do you try to
it's certainly not a stable identity thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a very shaky. And then, of course, you have like all those statements still like, a couple of days after the like re-election of Trump, you have like this Putin statement that we don't say no to integration. And, I like taking those things seriously. Like those people don't say things for nothing. Like those statements, they have audience.
I'm not familiar with the speech.
Yeah.
I have to rely on your sort of expertise and reasoning. I believe you that he said that, but I mean, just for any listeners, I mean, he certainly, and you can rule out that he meant some kind of integration, either in an Asian context with, say, Mongolia or China, he also, or North Korea for that matter, and he, didn't refer to what is often called the axis of resistance or thing. It's not about somehow, or now I had, what is it called? Crinks, right? Crink. Like China, Russia, Iran and North Korea. So
of course, in opposition to the West, there is no stable identity there. There is nothing there. It's just an alliance of convenience that you have like leaders who can oppose like American hegemony. But the moment, I would say from my analysis, I would really bet a lot of money that the moment the US calls Russia and says, it's like, you're my partner, you're my friend, Russians will go nuts. The Russians will really come to the US immediately and they will abandon this Chinese bullshit. And that's what they really want from the US. It's just like calling Russia and saying, you are a strategic partner, my friend. This is what they want. And this is what they
always
wanted.
The thing is, of course, that if you are... Yes, I mean... So if you take that, you know, assumption seriously, it will sort of make it a little bit, right, psychologically speaking, say no. But the behavior you... So if, it sounds cynical, but I mean, you know, if you just then have a look at what did Russians do, it would be as if you rationalized all the military, you know, aggression and everything as a kind of, you know, like a small kid, basically. You know, I mean... Telling a person to listen to, it's like to him or her. And I mean, of course, maybe I'm just, you know, using the wrong metaphor here. But
yeah,
I think it's
more like a kind of like a relationship where like a partner tries to kind of prove, you know, you didn't value me enough. Like, you know, this is kind of like what was going on with Russia. It's like you ask them that kind of like Russians, we will show you like what is our value. Like, and this is what they're doing, basically.
But certainly in your use of the word value now was a strategic value.
Yeah.
Certainly not, because that's hard to argue, right? That it would be about values in a wider sense or in a human rights or whatever.
No, value as a strategic kind of...
Sort of an asset.
Merit.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, in the 90s, like, Americans could not even see it. They couldn't even see that Russia has a value in the world. For them, it was kind of the end of the story because it was... which is a very poor country that was falling
apart. But
that's
still the thing about conflate. I mean, you do have that, and we have discussing that, you know, for a thousand times about, you know, the end of the Soviet Union as the, you know, biggest geopolitical catastrophe, that kind of famous Putin statement at the Munich Security Conference. And at the same time, you did have the sort of conflation of post-Soviet Russia as the successor of, or basically the new Soviet Union. So there was also never this kind of clear rift within, especially within US circles, to really, I mean, make a difference there and say, you know, Russia is really something different than the Soviet Union. I mean, in many ways, it was always a shortcut. And even in Soviet times, I mean, if you read articles, it's fascinating to see how oftentimes when, you know, analysts refer to the Soviet Union, they were writing Russians. So,
yeah.
Or Russia. So, I mean, in that sense, it's all also unclear. There is a conflation of two, and I think if anything positive were to come out of that, and if there ever, you know, was soon an end to the conflict that wouldn't lead to complete annihilation of Ukraine or, you know, the cessation of incredible, you know, large amounts of territory, even if there was what some people suggested, you know, some kind of referenda in the end, really be like true, transparent, democratic referenda that would, you know, somehow bring peace. I mean, of course, that would all be a great result, but I mean, it will then still take a lot of time. How this new partnership, or at least, you know, how you sort of would have built those ties with a future Russian state, most likely a new leadership. So I mean, it's I'm afraid we'll still have to wait for a number of years before we'll see more.
Certainly.
But I mean, like, I guess we will certainly see how the Trump presidency will change that dynamic of, you know, cohesion or building the BRICS. Also, we haven't talked about India yet, but I mean, also it's interesting to see how India's foreign policy is becoming more assertive from what I see. You know, if you follow all the aspects about an assassination of, you know, this leader in Canada, the entire diplomatic row there, then there are apparently also cyber threat or espionage actions by Indians or India in some Western states. I mean, it's all turning out to become even trickier. And so we'll see how. Again, I think we'll see soon. Also, when we now learn about how we'll actually join the Trump administration, that we have a first idea of how the foreign policy could look like. And we can only hope for the adults in the room, right? I mean, that not the most terrible decisions or proposals are on the table. But I mean, I'm still expecting something unorthodox or unusual. And we'll see what that could be. Maybe we can discuss that very soon next time.
Yes. Thank you, David. And see you in the next episode.
Thank you.